Hey, this is Tim Alexander. You might know me from playing drums in that band called Primus. The new Sound Cipher is coming out April 21st, 2023 on Royal Potato Family. Be sure and pick it up. Come see us if you get a chance and listen to the vinyl guide.
This episode is brought to you by Seems Easy Record Sleeve Repair Strips. If you collect used records, you need some Seems Easy strips handy for record sleeve repair. They're super easy to use and repair those seam splits to make them like new. Ask your record store for Seems Easy or go to seamseasy.com. Seems Easy with two Z's. Seamseasy.com. And now, on with the show. Well, hey everyone, it's Nate. Welcome to episode 388 of The Vinyl Guide, the podcast for record collectors and music nerds. And holy moly, peoples, today's guest is Mr. Tim Herb Alexander, who you may know from Primus, and he's got a fantastic new project, Sound Cipher, with Skerrick and Tim Mason. The album, All That Sinks Must Diverge, is absolutely captivating, and I can't wait to hear it on Glorious Vinyl. Available on Royal Potato Family Records, it's out April 21st. Vinyl can be had from your local shops. Just ask them to order Sound Cipher, or you can get direct from royalpotatofamily.com. And there's a few tracks on streaming services now. Go check them out for free and set yourself up to get the full album download on April 21st. Now today, Tim shares all about the story of Sound Cipher, as well as his other gig, being the drummer in Primus. We talk about Tim's love of analog recording, the story of the Primus Suck on This first press vinyl, touring in the early days, recording Sailing the Seas of Cheese, what Winona Ryder thought of the song Winona's Big Brown Beaver, the behind-the-scenes prep and shenanigans for the South Park 25th anniversary shows, and a whole lot more. It's a great conversation with a fantastic drummer who's seen some amazing stuff, and if you like this interview, there's even more available. Yes, there's an extended version of our conversation available only to our Patreon supporters at patreon.com/vinylguide. Head up there now, support the show, you get all sorts of extra stuff, and today is no exception. Help support the show, and you get extended and commercial-free interviews, high-resolution audio, and even the occasional videos and giveaways. That's patreon.com/vinylguide, where you get to hear the rest of the show. And there we go. Grab yourself a cold one, or a hot one, depending on the time of day. Have a nice comfy seat, and let's get into our chat with Tim Alexander.
Hello there.
Mr. Tim Alexander, how are you?
Hey, all right. Let me get, you're doing video, right?
Yeah, I do a video. I'll take a look at you. Oh, there you are.
All right.
Why would you ever want to hide that face?
Oh, my God.
Where in the world are you?
So I am in Mill Valley, California right now. Where are you at?
I'm in Sydney, Australia.
Oh, what time is it there?
It's Friday afternoon around 4 o'clock.
Oh, good. So it's a good time for you.
Yeah, perfect. Yeah. It's fine. It works fine. Yeah, not a problem at all. Hopefully, do you think we're going to see Sound Cipher down here on a tour in the next year or so?
Oh, man. It's an interesting concept for sure. This recording started out on a Primus tour. Skerrick was part of our band in the Wonk when we were doing the Chocolate Factory tour. We were doing the Willy Wonka music. Mm-hmm. And so me and him were just playing around at sound checks a couple times, and then that was when we said, hey, you know, maybe we should do something. And, you know, years pass and we finally get together, and Skerrick just like knows everybody. So he hooked it all up. He got the recording time set up at Litho in Seattle. And he's knows Randall Dunn, who produced it. And so we finally had some time booked, you know, and we're like, okay, we don't know what it's going to be. Nothing. You know, mm-hmm. We have no plans. We're just going to go in and record whatever happens. So I bring as much stuff as possible. I mean, the kit I used, I had four gongs, a hi-hat. I had my, you know, a lot of my concert tom drum set. So there's no bottom head. So I had octobons and concert toms, and I did have a hi-hat and like a couple effects, but I don't think I used regular cymbals. I brought my big Tibetan bowls. I brought crystal bowls, and you know, I wasn't sure what we were going to do. So we were going to make just sounds and just make all kinds of crazy things.
You brought everything just and in then, case you needed it. Yeah, you were prepared.
Yeah, yeah, brought everything, you know, and so we just took us like a most of the day just to mic stuff. But we got there, and Randall had this guy Tim Mason, and who was going to assist Randall in like creating the synth, kind of some synth stuff or things that we could play to, or and you know, he was set up in our studio and inside the playing room and where my drums were, and you know, he just started, you know, making sounds and doing stuff, and Skerrick and I were started, you know, playing to it, and then he became like a super intricate part of the record, and you know, then that became the music was all three of us now, and then Randall approached it almost like another musician in the band. What he's doing is taking just straight recording, straight microphones of sounds that we're making, and then he's using you know, various mixing techniques, editing, doing all kinds of stuff to make an experience. So this isn't, the recording's not about, hey, listen to us play. The recording's more about, we're going to play, Randall's going to do his thing, and then we're going to give you something to sit back and listen to. And it's not about, you know, me as a drummer from Primus and here, listen to, or me trying to do a pure recordings of my, you know, my ability to play the drums or whatever I can do, you know, not trying to capture a pure essence, you know, it's about, it's Skerrick, you know, just playing random things and building, like, it's almost like doing a painting or something, you know, we're just adding colors and techniques, and eventually the whole thing gets piled up, and there's four of us doing it, you know, there's me, Skerrick, Tim, and Randall, and you know, he was a producer as well, you know, trying to get good sounds, but also once the editing started happening, that's where it gets really interesting.
Going into the studio, know? Did you have any song structures? Did you have a few like riffs or things to start to work with, or was it entirely experimental?
No.
Okay.
It's 100% experimental, and not even knowing if it's even going to be good, if it's even going to be usable. We just book some time and like, let's record some stuff. I think we knew that our skill set would allow us to be in there, and we know we're going to get something. And even that, there's a lot of stuff that was like, it's like editing a movie. There's a lot of stuff that just ended up on the floor, you know, just cut out. Like,
yeah,
I had a lot of that. I was like, I don't like what I played there. Get rid of that. You know, I don't want that section, you know, forget that.
I guess there's got to be some pressure with that, but there's also a lot of freedom with that. I mean, that style of recording, yes. Is that pretty new to you? Have you done that before in your career?
Yes, I have. So I've let me see. So with a band Attention Deficit, I don't know if you've ever heard of them, but it's me, Michael Mannering, and Alex Skolnick. Mm-hmm. So this is back in the late 90s, I believe. Michael Mannering contacted me. I didn't know anything about him. He was kind of more of a new age bass player, I thought, you know. He did solo records and does some really crazy bass playing, you know. And so I played on one of his records. And then years later, he calls me and he's like, hey, there's a record label. I forget who it was who put it out, but there's a record label that wanted to.
Magna Carta.
Magna Carta, right. So Magna Carta, I guess, approached him as like, hey, put together something, you know, and do a project and we'll put it out, you know, or release it. And so he called me and he called Alex Skolnick. And I'm pretty sure it was through Michael. I don't know if Alex Skolnick. Yeah, pretty sure it was through Michael that got all arranged. But yeah, and that was the same thing. Our first record, literally, we went in and like had no idea what we were going to do. And it was an all digital recording. Since this is a vinyl show, so I'm kind of into, I like talking about the analog digital stuff as much as what little I know. But I, for some reason, I'm really interested in it. So it was done all digitally.
Right.
And so this was not Pro Tools. So this is pre when Pro Tools was just kind of starting to be a thing. So this was in one of those, God, what was the unit? I want to say it was like did Tascam have one of those boards?
It was like the Alesis, recorders, the ADATs, but it was the Tascam.
No, this is after ADATs.
Okay.
After ADATs. Cause we did one of the first ADAT albums, our Primus one? Album. I have okay. Primus album, Pork Soda.
Oh, that was ADAT.
Pork Soda was done entirely on ADATs. And before that, you know, we had been analog because up until that point, we were always doing 2-inch tape, mixing to 1/2-inch, and they would master from the 1/2-inch. So that is where you get a really pure analog vinyl recording. And there is, I'm sure maybe your vinyl people know, but a lot of people record into Pro Tools, which is all digital, that gets thrown into, what do they do? I think they just, I don't even know if it goes to an analog converter as it's cut into vinyl. No, so I don't know what that process is. Do you know?
Yeah, a lot of times they'll just send the high-resolution lossless files from the studio to the pressing plant. The pressing plant will then make a lacquer from those digital files. So
right, but what I'm saying is when it goes from the lossless file, what is that signal path that it gets into the lacquer? That's the part I'm talking about, because when you get a pure AAA analog to analog recording to the vinyl, it's taking the 1/2-inch and it's running it analog to the cutting knife or whatever you call it, the needle that cuts the, so that's a pure analog signal. And I did an album like that. It's called Into the Presence. I had an old man. I'm sorry. I'm going way out of tangents here. <That's okay. laughs> Anyways, but I did a record Into the Presence. I bought an old MCI 2-inch machine. I bought an MCI console. I bought all this stuff used, about an MCI 1/2-inch. Me and a friend of mine, Luis Maldonado, we recorded an all analog record. I took those 1/2-inch tapes down to a guy in Phoenix who cuts vinyl in an old machine. He did it right off the half inch tape. So a pure analog signal. So really cool. But that's a real, a real analog recording on vinyl. To me, that's what I love to find. You know, when I look for records, I don't have a giant collection, but yeah. Anyway,
you have an appreciation, but you have an appreciation for vinyl.
I really do. And I'm my family and I, we just haven't been really settled, and I haven't really invested in like getting a really good system to listen to. I don't know why. I feel weird listening to vinyl through, you know, digital amplifiers. For some reason it bugs me. I'd rather just listen through my, you know, headphones off an iPhone.
Right.
But if I'm listening to vinyl, then I'm feeling like, okay, I got to have a full analog signal, tubes, all that, you know. I haven't set that up yet. So I'm lame. But anyways, back to your question. I did Attention Deficit was a pure improvisational record. We went into this studio in Emeryville, California, and we didn't know what was going to happen. And we just played, and kind of a similar approach of just the mixing kind of and editing kind of made it cohesive. So similar thing with Sound Cipher. We tracked just tons of ideas. You know, these are not like verse, chorus, you know, this is all instrumental improv. And just when being an instrumentalist, I think we naturally think in terms of those dynamics of having the valleys and the peaks and whatever we're doing. So when it gets to tape or it gets on to Pro Tools or whatever it is, it's there's almost like some structure happening. So the key for Randall is to take the really good moments of that and make sense of them and put them, get them sounding good, and then make them in a way that it kind of forms a record, a listening experience.
I really enjoyed this record. I really did. And
You got to hear the whole thing?
I got to hear the whole thing. I got to hear it. Like, I was also like on an airplane. Cool. I had an 18-hour flight from Houston to Sydney. So I got to listen to it multiple times in multiple states. And I really enjoyed it. To me, it's also, I guess it's very, I was surprised about how emotional it got, especially with the electronic instruments. That's what really kind of,
Now that you bring that up, that is really something. How Tim and Skerrick both just turn their instrument just 180 degrees. You know, there's a lot of real staccato synth arpeggiated, all these crazy things happening a lot of times. And then it just flows into like these really sweet, awesome moments. Yeah. Thanks for bringing that up. Really cool.
Yeah. Look, I love Kraftwerk, but I'm not used to getting emotional while listening to it. So
I didn't. Wow. That's interesting. That's very cool.
So look, I've got a record here. Where I put it here. Is an all analog production.
Yes, it is. There it is, dude. That's 100% analog right there. Tascam. The Tascam 388. It was like a quarter inch tape, 8-track.
Yep.
And we did that at the Berkeley Square. Yeah. California.
I used to have a 388. I love the 388. I don't know why they discontinued.
So people can't see this, but that's the Primus Suck on This album.
Yes.
He's holding in his hands right
and,
now.
And this is one of the first, 1,000 copies that were made.
Because
as I recall, as I understand the story, Les's dad loaned you guys the money to be able to press 1,000 records.
That's very, very true, I would believe. Yes.
Okay.
And I think he also helped us get an RV to go do a tour to support that. We bought like some old RV and we went on tour, you know, with just like four of us or five of us. And we drove across the country to all these college radio station cities, you know, where all the college radio was. We sent those. We hand packed those and we put little cards inside them that said, hey, if you like this, where can we play? And oh. So the record DJs would send those back. And it says, yeah, you could try this club. So, you know, this is before the internet. This is before anything. We had to snail mail those postcards. And then it said, yeah, play this club and this club. And we ended up booking a tour all across the U.S. That's how we first got out there. And
it was based on recommendations
we sent out.
Based on recommendations, yes, from a postcard that was stuck inside the record. That's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, that's how we got our first tours going. And we drove across the country and lived off of pizza and, you know, free pizzas from the clubs and the hotel room, or, you know, one hotel room for all five of us. And but the RV was cool. We could sleep in the RV in most places, most times. Sometimes we get one room that we could all take a shower in and stuff, you know.
Right.
But, and we pulled a little U-Haul trailer with all the gear in it. And then Les and Larry printed up all the merchandise, the t-shirts. So if you got that early merchandise, those were handmade by Les and Larry. Yeah.
Wow.
So
real DIY affair.
Oh, yeah. I know. That's how it was.
Primus was a band. I mean, it truly sounded like no other, but really before or since. I mean, really unique petri dish, right?
Yeah. Right, right.
Brave musical choices, a bit of a bizarre persona. Was it difficult to be taken seriously, especially in the early days?
So I think that's been an ongoing thing. I mean, I guess you kind of got to ask what is seriously, you know, because the way Les does, you know, the writing of his lyrics, it's, everything is kind of from a third person viewpoint and what their characters might be going through, things like that, you know? So, you know, it's not a direct in your face love song or anything like that. So it's serious in the sense that it's our livelihood. It's what we have done since we were 13 or 14 years old, you know, I mean, it's serious in the sense that, hey, this is what we dedicated our lives to. And I mean, that's as serious as you get, you know, and, the music, it's just, so me and Larry joined Primus had already been playing around the Bay Area for like a while before we joined the band. And so they had this demo tape called Sausage. So I think a bunch of the songs on that record were from that demo, but me and Larry, you know, obviously recorded it cause we're playing live, but I'll just tell the story real quick, but I was working in a cafe in Oakland. And a buddy of mine that was working with me was playing the demo. And I thought the music was interesting. And he said, yeah, you know, they're looking for a drummer. And my friend didn't know that I played drums. And so I told him, I was like, oh, well, I play. You know, can you find out, you know, get information? And so the next time he went to one of their shows, he got a phone number from Les, and then I called and we set up an audition. So I auditioned with Todd, the original guitar player, Todd Hoof. And we hit it off because we really all enjoyed Rush. So we played Rush riffs and the thing about playing Rush riffs is we only really do like, you know, that main part that everyone knows. And then you just kind of fall apart because we never really learned the entire song note to note. So we knew like the, you know, the dan, da, dan, 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 you know, you play that and then you're like, well, after that, there's nothing else you can do because it gets too complicated. But we played all kinds of Rush riffs and so we got along that way. But then the next, you know, I think the next day or so, Les calls me and goes, so I got good news and bad news. So the good news is we liked you and we want you to join the band. But the bad news is Todd just quit. So now Les lost his drummer and his guitar player. But now I'm now the drummer. And now we don't have a guitar player. And so he calls up Larry because he had some other auditions that he wanted to finish. So him and Larry finished the auditions, but he had already, I mean, he, you know, really liked me. So, that became the band with Larry, me and Les. And we, a month later we recorded that record. The show was booked. The show was booked and he lost his band. And so me and Larry come in. And so we learn all the songs. And then we wrote some new stuff too. That's on that record too. So
which songs were pretty nearly baked and which ones did you write for the record?
Okay. What's first?
John the Fisherman.
Yeah. So that one is an old one. That's from the demo tape. What's next?
Groundhog Day
was from the demo.
The Heckler.
Heckler was one of the new ones we did.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure.
Pressman and then Jalikit. Or Jalikit.
Jalikit. Well, Jalikit was on the demo. I think Pressman was something I can't remember correctly, but it was not, I don't think it was on the demo. But I think he had kind of had that music laying around.
Okay. Tommy the Cat, that was on the demo.
That was on the demo. I think so.
Putting Time, Harold on the Rocks, and then Frizzle Fry.
Putting Time, that, Jesus, was that on the demo? I don't know if that was on the demo. Harold of the Rocks was on the demo.
Okay.
And what else was it?
Frizzle Fry.
Frizzle Fry was on the demo.
Okay.
Yeah, so we had two or three tunes that we kind of wrote for the show, and then we did as much of the existing material we can because Les was worried about coming out entirely with two new people having all new music. So we kind of kept those existing songs and then the way me and Larry play it, we're more rock and heavier. I think me and Larry have more of a heavier vibe than Todd and Jay Lane, who played drums before me. I think it Primus was way more groove funk influenced.
Yeah.
And I was more rock, you know, Zeppelin, Rush, and Larry, you know, had come from a heavy metal band Possessed at that time, but he was really into the Grateful Dead as well. So he had a mixed or whole range, and I had a whole range from playing a bunch of reggae, ska, dance music, and loving Rush and Zeppelin, and so I had a wide range of musical genres that I played because I played in a band in Arizona, a dance band kind of live, you know, we played shows on the weekends. So
it seems to me with Primus, even though there were only three of you, the musical styles and the capabilities that you brought were, you know, each of you tremendous. It must've been difficult at times, if not consistently, to find those pockets where you could improvise or go off script a little bit without kind of disturbing the balance of the trio. Was that an issue at all?
In the beginning, I think we were pretty song stuck to the structure of the song. I think as we, the more and more we played, we found moments where we could stretch. Before I was in Primus, the band I played in, we had lots of improvisation times in music because we were kind of a world beat. This band called Major Lingo is a world beat band out of Arizona. And, you know, I learned that was my first band out professionally playing and making money. And I was like 18, I think, when I joined. I wasn't even supposed to be in the bars. Mm-hmm. And because I couldn't, you know, I couldn't drink. I wasn't legal. But so we did, you know, full weekend dance stuff. So we did a lot of world music, from Irish folk music to reggae to Afrobeat to mm-hmm. songs like, you know, ska and reggae. And so I kind of was used to improvising and just playing and keeping it going, you know. And then in Primus, you know, we kind of at first was all, it was more song structure, not a lot of stretching out. And then as we got going a little bit, it just became more and more of, there's moments where we can kind of go. And then the verses, where there's lyrics, there's a little structure. And then in between, you know, it's just kind of, we have a light structure usually, but sometimes, yeah, we just break away from it. And it's never been a problem. It's yeah. I think we've always kind of had the ability to do that fairly easily.
Going from Suck on This to Frizzle Fry, a lot of the songs on Suck on This, you know, there was a studio version that went to Frizzle Fry. But
exactly,
Tommy the Cat didn't make that leap. Tommy the Cat didn't get on a studio album until Sailing the Seas of Cheese. Any reason why Tommy the Cat was left off of Frizzle Fry?
We'll be back after these messages.
Hey everyone, I'm here to talk to you about Seems Easy record sleeve repair strips. Ever find a record in a used bin where the vinyl is gorgeous, but the sleeve has this ugly split and is even falling completely apart? Well, that's okay, grab it anyway, because with Seems Easy record sleeve repair strips, you can fix that right up. Seems Easy record repair strips repair seam splits from the inside, so it doesn't affect the appearance of a record sleeve, but it does make it functional again. With Seems Easy, records can now slide in and out like new. Turn a $5 used record into a $50 functioning collectible. Just ask your local record shop for Seems Easy strips, and if they're not in stock, go to seamseasy.com. That's Seems Easy with two Z's. Seems Easy record sleeve repair strips. Seems easy because it is. Oh, and hey, record nerds, don't forget to clean your records with the very best and safest record cleaner, the Groove Washer. Make your records look and sound their very best and store them with confidence using the new Groove Washer Groove Guard record sleeves. You gotta try this out. It makes a huge difference to the quality of your vinyl experience. Ask for the Groove Washer by name at your local record store and accept no substitutes. Or head over to groovewasher.com and use discount code VINYLGUIDE. 10.
All hail the Groove Washer.
That's groovewasher.com, discount code VINYLGUIDE10.
Now we return to the program, already in progress.
No limits. Tommy the Cat didn't get on a studio album until Sailing the Seas of Cheese. Any reason why Tommy the Cat was left off of Frizzle Fry?
I can't remember what the reason is, but we definitely, when we did it on Seas of Cheese, it had, I think it had changed quite a bit, at least in my perspective, you know, what with the stuff that I was playing, because when I first did it, it was pretty much the way that I had learned it, you know. But by the time we did it on Seas of Cheese, I had already kind of been finding my own feel, you know.
Right.
So really too busy, too many notes, overplaying all that. Yeah.
Do you recall any memories of Tom Waits doing those vocals? It seems like it's a lot for him to say. I don't think he's used to going that fast.
Yeah, you know, I wasn't there. And it was kind of like more less I think Larry was there with him, but yeah, I wasn't there. And they, I think Tom wanted it to just kind of be real low key. Didn't like, don't want a bunch of people hanging out. And, you know, I would just be sitting there hanging out. So I don't know. I wasn't there. So,
okay. As you're making a name for yourself, Primus is kind of is out there playing Lollapalooza, growing in popularity. Your style continues to develop and mature. Do you start to meet some of these people who really influenced you early on? Neil Peart and those sort of
folks. Oh my God, yes. Oh man, yes. That was the really crazy thing was, I mean, our path, it just was like a slow climb in terms of selling a little more records, the ability to make a little more records, make a little more money, and just slowly climbing up, doing more tour. And then all of a sudden we start getting like, I mean, it was pretty incredible on our, was it Suck on This? It might've been our first tour. We ended up in a club in, I want to say Columbus, Ohio. And I go into this club, you know, it's like I'm really tired and I'm sitting at the bar and the band we're opening for is doing their sound check. And I sit down and I'm just getting a drink, like a Coke or something, you know, to wake up. And they start playing the song called Loud Love. And it was Soundgarden.
Yeah.
And that was one of the first cool bands that we opened for and they started playing and just blew my mind. I was like, oh my God, what is this? It was amazing. And then from then on, I was like the biggest Soundgarden fan. And so those kind of things happened a lot for us. We were really fortunate. We got to be friends with some of the, you know, not too close, but yeah, we got to be friends with Soundgarden guys. We toured a lot with Fishbone, another great band. They influenced us a lot, you know. And then, you know, on Jane's Addiction, another one is our first Europe tour. We got to open for Jane's Addiction, and that was incredible. And then, you know, we get back to, yeah, and as we make our first major label record, it was Sailing a Seas of Cheese. Mm-hmm. And so we're fortunate that the video Jerry got a lot of, I mean, fairly, not a ton. It wasn't Nirvana, but we got some good MTV play.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was cool. And it helped. That helped kind of get the word out there a lot. Then all of a sudden, we're just like doing the Rush tour, you know, opening for Rush. We've got to open for U2. It's weird. It's interesting how our band can maneuver in these different realms of music. You know, there was a tour where it was Public Enemy, Anthrax, Primus, and everyone thought like it was just going to be a violent mess, you know, having rap guys and then white metal kids and, you know, like it was, and everyone got along great, you know, and crowd wise, I mean, you know, like the crowds will be two Public Enemy fans versus, you know, Anthrax or Primus fans, you know, like it wouldn't get along, but it meshed great. Yeah. And all the metal heads loved Public Enemy, you know, and I don't know what the Public Enemy fans thought of Anthrax or Primus though. So,
I saw that tour in Oakland.
Oh, you did? All right.
And it was the night Oakland Hills were on fire. There was a big fire in Oakland Hills. And I was debating
even
to make that show or not, because I didn't know if everything would be closed or if we're going to have to evacuate because the fires were so bad.
Right. But man, I remember that the helicopter was dipping into the Lake Merritt right there.
Oh,
was picking up water. Yeah, I totally. It was pulling water out and going up into the hills that day.
It was It was at the Henry J. Kaiser Convention Center, I remember. And I remember looking out the windows, and I could see the fire on the hills in the distance. Like, it was visible. And we were inside just high and having a great time.
Wow.
So that was going into Sailing the Seas of Cheese, that was, like you say, your first major label record, Interscope's involved. Do you recall the expectations? Do you recall the pressure of that? Or was there a lot of confidence? No problem. Just make the record and go.
I think I want to say that they liked us because of what we did. They weren't trying to make us into something else.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, it was, we do our thing, and they were a brand new label. We were like the first rock thing they had. The only other artist before they had on that at the time was Gerardo. And so they only had a couple artists on the label at the time that we signed. So yeah, we were early on in the beginning of Interscope Records.
Okay. Did you ever hear from any Winonas about the song Winona's Big Brown Beaver?
You know, Les got, I think he got word that Winona Ryder wasn't happy about it. And but, you know, it had nothing to do with her. It's and Les tells the story. It's actually a real story. He was walking down this path of fishing, and this beaver just smashed his tail into the ground, scared the shit out of him. And Les just says he remembers this big brown beaver, you know? And then I think the name Winona just came out of a rhyme or something, you know, that he was doing and didn't really have I don't remember the specifics on the name, but you know, there was nothing intentional about it. But you know, the weird thing was, you know, we made this video. It's a very cool video. And Les, you know, does a lot of directing, and he worked with Mark Kaur too. So they really did some really clever images in those videos. And the interesting thing was that MTV made us like, we couldn't say some like silly words, like some just silly words that weren't even vulgar or anything. And then they eventually just wouldn't play the song because they thought it was talking about, you know, the beaver in terms of the non-animal. And, you know, it was like, come on. So really didn't do too much, but man, it was a good video. It was really cool.
I remember that. So yeah. Winona Ryder didn't like that. Winona Judd, never heard from.
I don't think we heard from her.
How far in advance were you guys working on the South Park 25th Anniversary Festival?
Yeah, you know, that was an interesting thing. We got together in L.A. for a couple days for the initial rehearsals. And there were some songs floating around that, you know, we needed to, you know, just kind of listen to that are from the various shows that they've done. And so we got together in LA, and one day was with just me, Les, and Lair. And then the next day was when Wing came, and then they did a bunch of songs with Trey and Matt. And then there was a day when we were all together. So it really, it was 3 days. And those first 3 days was just kind of piecing together what was going to possibly happen. And there was a rough kind of roadmap sketched out after that, you know, it was like, okay, our next rehearsals turned out to be the week of the show. And we still don't know what we're doing. And it was crazy, crazy. And I guess, you know, there's a documentary on Matt and Trey when they're doing South Park. And I guess, that's just how they work. They just kind of throw it to, they just do their work up until that last minute and boom, it's done. And it's just like amazing.
Yeah.
So I saw that, you know, and I just didn't think about it that this would be that same process, but it seemed like it was a similar process of, you know, we got together like 3 or 4 days before the show and started rehearsing. And even then it felt like, gosh, we still like, what is happening? Are we doing this song or are we not doing this song? What's going on? And it was so wild. And then they, you know, towards the end of the week, we kind of had a set going. But even then it wasn't 100% yet. It was still like up to the last moment of just like, well, you know, we might do this. I don't know. We'll see. We may.
Did anything go horribly wrong?
No, that's what's awesome. Everything went perfect. And I think Matt and Trey had their vision of what they're going to do. So, you know, me, I'm the drummer and I don't really know much about what all the stuff they have planned. You know, but they had the vision going. So, but from my perspective, it was like, what the hell is happening? Are we even going to be able to do this? You know, but it was really, really cool. It was fantastic, actually. So
at what point did you hear about Alex Lifeson and Geddy Lee participating?
Yeah. So I think like the last day of rehearsal, I heard that Alex and Geddy were going to come and surprise Matt for this. And then I heard it was like, I think it was like the right at the end of the day, I think I was told that we're going to go the day of the second show. We're going to go rehearse during the day with Geddy and Alex, just me, Les, and Larry. And so that's when I knew, oh shit, they're going to play. They're going to come out and play, you know, and for us, that's huge. You know, we've never, and we toured with them and we never all got on a stage and played a Rush song together. That never happened. And so here we are. So me and Les and Lair were like super excited and just can't believe it. Okay, we're gonna go play with these guys. All right, cool. So we get to the theater, and there they are. You know, we're friends and we all say hi and so we start playing and then Geddy starts singing. We didn't know he was gonna sing. And then we were like, oh my God, this is like it. This is like the biggest moment that for me and Les, I know, me and Les were looking at each other like, oh wow, this is really happening right now. Geddy is singing Closer to the Heart. Alex is playing, you know, too bad. I mean, it's extremely unfortunate Neil wasn't there. And this was a childhood dream. I literally 13, 14 years old in the basement of where I was living, listening to Rush albums and just never could imagine 40 years later, I would be sitting in a club, in a room with Geddy and Alex playing their song, you know, without Neil, and I'm kind of doing Neil's role.
Yeah.
you know, what the hell, you know? So 100%, man. they came out and did it. And it was like you see in the show, that's 100%. Matt did not know this was happening. It was a complete surprise. And so Getty and Alex come out, and it wasn't staged or anything. Matt just, everyone kept it a secret, and Matt never found out about it until we actually did it. So it was just incredible. Yeah.
Oh, phenomenal. And that takes you right back to the very beginning of Suck on This, the YYZ. Were you guys opening the shows, climate shows with YYZ?
We do that a lot. Yeah. Okay. We do that a lot. And it was kind of the, you know, just our Rush influence of when we first got together and played, you know. I mean, I didn't do it with Larry. I did it. I auditioned with Todd, but that's like one of the things we did. We played YYZ as far as we, up until it gets really crazy, you know?
Yeah.
But, and that's about as much as we did, like on that record. It's just the first, it's just those first bars, you know, and then we're done.
It throws down the gauntlet, though. It just says, like, okay, you know, these guys know their shit.
That was, and then doing the, we, on our last few tours, we've been doing the Farewell to Kings album. And that was really amazing.
How did that concept come together to do the full Rush album and to make it Farewell to Kings?
Yeah, I think it was just mostly, the idea had been thrown around a lot. The timing just seemed to be right. We were actually going to do it before Neil had died. You know, we had been talking about doing this for a long time. It just seemed like we were planning to do it, and then things came up, then it didn't happen. And then the next year came around, and then COVID happened, and then Neil passed away. And it was just, you know, it just kept like not happening. And then finally, it was just everything lined up.
The stars aligned.
And yeah, it was really cool.
It would be fantastic to see that show, especially in Australia. Rush never toured Australia. And
oh, really?
Yeah. So there's a lot of prog fans here that, I mean, they absolutely love Rush, but they've never had the chance to see. I grew up in the Bay Area. I saw Rush probably half a dozen times or something. They were coming through.
Right.
But down here, they're completely starved for them. In fact, years before Neil was, you know, passed away, there was a huge kind of online movement, a petition to bring Rush to Australia at least once.
Don't know why that didn't happen. Yeah. And I know, I don't know. I think it mainly comes from Australia. We would have come down for sure to do it if there were offers to do it. I don't think anyone wanted us to come do it.
Well, I do. So, you guys can stay at my
house.
Yeah,
I know. You got to talk to the guys in charge down there, man.
You guys don't mind cats, do
get
you?
It going. Yeah.
That may be the deal breaker. Okay, look, Tim, I'm going to start wrapping up. Is there anything you want to talk about we haven't talked about?
Let's see. Well, I think this is mainly letting people know about the Sound Cipher. So, you know, we do have the album's going to be released on the 21st of April, and we have two shows happening. And we've only done a couple shows in the history of our existence. One of them we did in a big planetarium with a laser show that went all over the sky, man. It was so incredible. So the album comes out on the 21st. Of April, All That Sinks Must Diverge is the title. And it's on the Royal Potato Family label. Yeah. And so I would say, tell everybody, do not listen to this. You do not want to be exposed to the large amount of voltage and electrons that are flowing through all circuits. It might harm you.
So this is the anti-promotion. Everyone stay away from sound science.
Everyone stay away. You might get hurt. It might really send you down the wrong path. But we've got some shows coming up the 21st of April in Seattle. And then the 22nd in Portland. Okay. So if anyone wants to brave a flight. Oh, we're talking about trying to do a live stream too. Ooh. I was thinking, I brought it up to the guys. Yeah, I was like, you know, it'd be cool to kind of make this something online because, you know, people aren't going to be able to have access. A lot of people won't be able to, you know, fly out to see a show, but maybe the hardcore people will. Mm-hmm. But yeah, we're talking about trying to live stream it on the 24th. So keep an ear out and an eye on Google.
Yep.
And hopefully the word will be out that if that's going to happen.
Cool. Well, look, that live stream sounds like the only way at least I'll be able to see it in the near future. But hopefully we'll see you and Sound Cypher or even the Farewell to Kings down in Australia at some point. But I do want to remind folks, Sound Cypher, All That Sinks Must Diverge. It is on vinyl, royalpotatofamily.com. I love this label. Everything that Kevin and team does over at Royal Potato Family is of utmost quality. And so I think you guys found a very good home there with this album. The cover of it, what's the cover of the album? What's the animal? It's this extinct animal, isn't it? On the cover of the album?
You know, Tim Mason found that image and we thought, oh, that's interesting. So let's go with that.
I've seen that picture.
I don't
before.
Know what it is.
It's some
really?
Sort of.
I don't know what it is.
It's some sort of extinct animal. I think that went that died out like in the early part of the 20th century. But oh well. Now.
Oh wow.
I'll do a little homework on that. But okay, Sound Cypher, All That Sinks Must Diverge. It's available on limited vinyl. There is a limited number of vinyl. I think it's about 500. Available at royalpotatofamily.com. Make sure you grab a copy of it. It's only $20. Lock yours in and get ready to enjoy it. I can't wait to hear it on vinyl. I've heard the digital files. They sound beautiful. I'm sure it's going to be another level when I hear the actual record. So again, Tim, thank you so much for joining us here and sharing the stories and the insight. And I got to tell you, your drumming has been part of the soundtrack of much of my life, certainly of many of the quality moments.
Wow. Thank you so much, man.
No worries. Look, and it was always one of those things growing up in the Bay Area and knowing Primus was from the Bay Area, you guys always right. made us proud, you know, at least the folks that I knew and the people that I knew, it's like it was so much respect for the band because, you know, you guys were doing this new thing and sounding incredible and brought this level of musicianship out there that no one could argue with. And the way that you guys just handled the popularity and, as you say, the kind of the escalator going up and up and up was, you know, really respectful. And it was always one of those things to where I was always proud to come from the same geography as the band. The other projects you've been involved in, again, you know, great quality stuff. Pucifer, A Perfect Circle, Laundry, which I am familiar with, I think is one of the greatest band names, yeah. I think, of the last 100 years. But Sound Cypher, again, another great project that I'm very glad exists. So, again, everyone, get a vinyl copy at royalpotatofamily.com. And Tim, you're welcome back on the Vinyl Guide anytime you want to nerd out, man.
Awesome. Thank you so much for having me. And yes, I'll be listening to more stuff of yours for sure.
Yeah, please do. All right. Thank you so much, Tim, for stopping by the Vinyl Guy. He's very friendly. That conversation could have been 3 hours. Absolutely enthralled talking with Tim, hearing all those stories. And by the way, there is more of this conversation available at patreon.com/vinylguide. Head up there now, help support the show, and get all the extras. And that's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Thank you so much for tuning in. Please share these episodes on your social media. Put them out on Facebook, tweet them out on Twitter.
find some Reddit forums to drop them into, even some Facebook user groups, whatever. Help spread the word of the Vinyl Guide. That is always appreciated. And we'll be back shortly with a brand new episode. So until we talk next time, get out there and buy some records, people. Cheers.
That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Send your thoughts to Nate@thevinylguide.com or follow or tag us on Instagram @vinylguide. Until next time, keep spinning.